It's Morning Edition on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Deaths from domestic violence have reached a number we haven't seen in Georgia in 10 years. At least that's one conclusion in the annual Fatality Review Report from the state's Commission on Family Violence and the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Jennifer Thomas is executive director of the State Commission on Family Violence. Taylor Tabb is the Fatality Review Project Coordinator for the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Ms. Thomas, I'll start with you. It's the obvious question. Is the reason for the increase in domestic violence deaths because there are actually more of them, or because we're getting better reporting or a better ability to link previously unattributed deaths to the actual cause?
I think the reason why we're seeing these numbers is that over the past 12 years of this project, we've improved our process for being able to gather data and to adequately track down domestic violence-related homicides. Our state doesn't have a uniform or a particular reporting for domestic violence homicides, and so we rely...
So if an officer or a coroner comes upon a scene and makes a report, there's no checkbox for that.
There may be a checkbox, but there's not a particular system for which we track those to say domestic violence homicides. So the coalition and the commission, we track domestic violence homicides through media monitoring and also working closely with victim advocates at prosecutors' offices around the state. So we rely heavily on what the media reports, and then we track and follow up on homicides to see, you know, was there a relationship between the two individuals where that homicide occurred.
So, Ms. Tabb, if you don't have a systematic way of tracking data, a diligent one, but maybe not a systematic one, then how can you come up with the kinds of solutions that might actually address the problem?
Well, that is where the Fatality Review Project comes into play. Because the idea behind Fatality Review Project is to take a look backwards to see where the gaps are in services. We don't focus so much on the homicide, but we look back to see what systems were these people interacting with in the years prior to their homicide. How did they know about these systems? How did the systems respond when they asked for help? And we're really looking to shine a light on where the gaps are.
Where are the gaps right now?
When we interview families, we're frequently interviewing them 3 to 5 years after the homicide has occurred, and we're finding families that are still deep in their grief. We're finding families that were never connected with supportive services in their community. That's a huge gap that we've seen year after year, is that there are supports in communities, but particularly when there's a murder-suicide. And the family is never connected to, let's say, the victim advocate in the prosecutor's office who would have helped them connect with other resources, help them apply for crime victims compensation. That's not happening when there's a murder-suicide, and it's a huge gap. And so children are not getting the supports they need. They're not getting counseling. And there's ways that that could easily be addressed, that particular gap.
Such as?
Well, so for instance, let's say a law enforcement respond to the scene of a murder-suicide. They could offer the family to connect with the victim witness advocate in the prosecutor's office. And in most jurisdictions, that wouldn't be so many cases that it would be overwhelming on the victim witness advocate to connect that family to resources in the community. But what we've also found is that because families... There's just this huge upheaval that occurs after a homicide in families. It's just devastating. And people can't really absorb all the information about what resources exist at the time. So then there's this law enforcement response. There may be prosecution. But that first year for people, if you think about it from a trauma perspective, is just like trying to find their new normal. They're in a fog. And We can hand them brochures and pamphlets and information, but I really think there's a period where they could absorb that information better if we had a way that we followed up with them 6 months later, a year later. And in most situations, that doesn't occur. So that is something that communities could work on, and it would be a fairly simple fix in most situations that wouldn't require additional funding.
I think we look at that of the 139 homicides that we had last year, 80% of those were firearms related. And so it's important for us to take a deeper dive and to look at access to firearms. Should we be looking at legislation that would remove firearms from the hands of known domestic violence offenders? Leaving a domestic violence relationship is a very dangerous time for a victim. And many times they will get a temporary protective order. And federal law allows for the removal of a firearm if you have a temporary protective order. And so this is something that Georgia law has not sort of codified the federal law on. And I think it's time for us to start asking ourselves the serious question, is it time for us to start looking and seeking ways to remove firearms from known DV offenders?
And Ms. Tabb, that brings up a complicated question because some domestic violence victims feel, okay, I need to get a firearm for my own protection. And gun rights advocates would certainly argue that if more women had this kind of protection, maybe there would be fewer deaths, at least deaths of people who were attacked.
Well, I think that's a little bit of a misnomer. Jennifer and I both worked in direct services prior to our positions with these statewide agencies, and I rarely heard from women that they felt like they needed to get a weapon to protect themselves. And I think what we know also is that that rarely works out that way, that when you have a firearm, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're safer. And there's research that also suggests that even just the presence of a firearm in the home, no matter whose weapon it is, increases the rate of death for domestic violence victims.
And I would just follow up with that we have seen and we know cases, I know personally cases, where victims of domestic violence have used a weapon to protect themselves, and unfortunately they have ended up with a life sentence because they used protection to protect themselves, used the gun to protect themselves, but ended up being charged with murder and are now sitting in prison.
You mentioned the high rate of fatalities which involve firearms. Was there anything else striking this year that you either hadn't seen in previous years or is showing up more than it has in previous years?
I wanted to make a comment about the other reason why we think we're seeing this increase this year is a phenomenon that we've been tracking for a while but really noticed this year, and that is that of familicide. And familicide is typically defined as the killing of an intimate partner plus another person, and then sometimes killing themselves. And we noticed several instances where there were multiple deaths in single incidences.
So in other words, someone kills a partner, a lover, a spouse, and kills the children too.
Right, exactly. And
any idea why this is happening more?
Well, I wanted to say that we tracked six incidents where 3 to 5 people died, totaling 24 of those deaths out of the 139. So that's rather significant. And this is very troubling to us. So one of the focus of the 2016 Fatality Review Project is going to be taking a deeper look into familicides and saying, are there risk markers that are atypical to these cases? Are there trends that we're not noticing or haven't picked up on before? And really taking a look to see, you know, what can be done around this phenomenon.
So of those homicides, 139 homicides, 24 of those deaths were bystanders or children or other individuals, not the primary victim. So
they weren't the initial targets, in other words.
Correct, yes. And I think it's also important to note that last year we had 20 murder-suicide cases resulting in 61 deaths in our state as well. So through this familicide, deeper dive into looking at familicides, we also, that will give us the opportunity to explore murder-suicide and look for ways that we might be missing some predictors or indicators of that from the perpetrator.
The other striking number in this review was the numbers of children who witnessed the deaths of their parent, their caregiver, whatever it might be. Is that a sharp increase from years past?
It's not. That number is about one-third has remained consistent mm-hmm. over the past several years. But it is something that we find troubling. And we took a really close look at in this report that I encourage listeners to take a look at children exposed to domestic violence. If we look at reports that are given to the GBI of family violence incidences across our state, over 12,000 children were present at domestic violence or family violence calls that law enforcement responded to. So not only one-third of the cases that we've reviewed, but we know that lots of children are in those homes where law enforcement's being called, and then beyond that, incidences where law enforcement are not even being called to respond.
Ms. Tabb, obvious question here. We have had awareness programs and prevention programs for decades now. The Fatality Review Report is 12 years old now. Why is this happening with all this awareness and emphasis on prevention, on prosecution, on protection? Why are we continuing to see an increase in deaths and in, as we just mentioned, multiple deaths?
Well, it's interesting because when we started the Fatality Review Project in 2004, we were told by other states that had gone before us to start domestic violence fatality review projects that this work can take years to unfold. And people are slow to change, unfortunately. And I think the changes that are necessary are sometimes hard. They sometimes require additional funding. They definitely require collaboration across systems that don't normally collaborate with each other. So I think there's it points to a need to really dig in to the recommendations that have been made. I think we know in Georgia, now that we've had this project for 12 years, we know what the problems are. The conversations that we're having in South Georgia with the teams down there are the same conversations that we're having in North Georgia. As you mentioned earlier, we're not learning anything new at this point. We know this. We just have to take action and implement these recommendations at this point.
So, Ms. Thomas, I'll put you on the spot a little bit. We're in the middle of the budget process now at the Capitol. How much did you ask for the Georgia Commission on Family Violence for fiscal 2017?
We did not ask for any increases in the fiscal budget for this year.
If we're looking at this kind of increase in domestic violence deaths, why not ask for increases in funding?
That's a great question that you've posed. The Commission on Family Violence, we do not provide direct service work. And so we advocate for funding, increased funding, to go directly to domestic violence programs or sexual assault centers around the state. So the commission is not asking for more money to do our work. What we're advocating for is increased funding for programs that are actually providing direct service work for victims. And also we advocate for prosecutors and law enforcement, GBI, for those folks to get an increase in funding so that they can better respond to the incidences out.
But you're obviously providing information to those frontline providers. Are you saying here they have all the information they need, the resources need to go to the front lines?
I'm saying that we serve a purpose by gathering this data and helping to work in a coordinated way with systems across the state. We receive federal funding, and we are always looking for increased grant funding to be able to fill some of those gaps that we have internally. Again, we believe that if we can get increased funding for direct services, that's a better service for the victims of domestic violence.
Ms. Tabb, which direct services are most in need right now?
You know, something that we hear from survivors is that they need transportation, they need affordable housing, they need childcare. You know, these are all things that people have to consider when they're considering fleeing an abusive relationship.
Because it goes to the age-old question of why do they stay, right?
Well, and economics is a key factor. I mean, economic stability, I think, would be one of the number one factors of whether or not someone can leave and stay gone. If you have to make a decision between, you know, putting a roof over your child's head and feeding them or living in your car, I mean, I think anybody knows what decision they would make in that situation, regardless of the circumstances at home.
Yeah, I'll just say another area that we've advocated for at the Capitol this session is increased funding for civil legal services for victims of domestic violence. That's a grant that goes to the Administrative Office of the Court during the recession that received a cut. And so little by little, we're getting back up to pre-recession levels, and we're advocating very strongly. What that funding provides assistance for is victims that are seeking temporary protective orders to be able to have a lawyer go with them to those hearings so that they may be able to obtain a temporary protective order.
Are you getting that funding that you've asked for?
We have gotten the funding that we've asked for the civil legal funding, and I expect that we'll continue to get that.
We mentioned a moment ago the question of why does somebody stay? Are we seeing, after all these years, awareness increase among those who maybe are finding themselves in the situation for the first time? In other words, they're not repeat victims yet. Are we seeing that awareness and that knowledge of, okay, I can go get help? Is that even getting through?
For me, one of the key findings that's most disturbing is that half of the victims of the cases that we've studied began that relationship between the ages of 13 and 24. And we have to do a better job of talking to teens and preteens about what an unhealthy relationship is. I think with media and with TV and all the things that we're inundated with, there is a misconception about what an unhealthy relationship looks like. And I think it's our responsibility as adults to do a better job of helping teens identify unhealthy trends in a relationship. You know, your boyfriend texting you 50 times a day to know where you are doesn't mean he really loves you. Could mean that he has some unhealthy behaviors that could lead to further controlling actions by him. So are individuals reaching out for services? It's disturbing to me that more individuals of the cases that we have studied reached out to their faith community than to the local domestic violence program. I think a reason behind that is that there is such a negative stigma attached to the label victim. And so maybe part of this work for us in this field is to break down those barriers and to break down the negative connotation or labeling of what it means to be a victim and talk about our services in more general ways that make it accepting or okay for people to call the 1-800 domestic violence crisis line.
Ms. Tabbitt, as you look at these numbers, are there any trends that you can see that will give you any hope? In other words, something to seize on to say we can cut this rate of deaths from domestic violence. There's something we're doing here that may pay off. Or is it more what we're not doing that we need to do?
It's really pretty grim if you read the fatality report. It's not a light read. But I think there is hope, because the hope is in the recommendations. The hope is in the change. And the hope is in the stories such as Trisha's that we shared. Trisha talks about what she experienced as a child, witnessing her mother being abused, witnessing her mother time after time attempting to leave this person and feeling as though she just kept hitting a roadblock every time. And Trisha, unfortunately, did end up losing her mother to homicide. But there is resilience and hope in her story, because she's in such a good place now, and she is sharing her story and hoping that people will learn from that and really be galvanized to find out what's happening in your community around this issue. Where can you plug in? Are you a part of a faith community? Could you invite a speaker to come in and talk? You know, what you can do in your own life to address this issue, because there are things that can be done no matter where you're situated personally or professionally.
Last year, there were two individuals that I knew personally that were killed as a result of domestic violence. So this hits close to home, even for those of us who do this work. And when I think about these families now, as they sit down at every holiday table, at every event, for the rest of those children's lives, there will be an empty seat there where their mother should be sitting. And that is what motivates me, and that's what guides me to try to fill these gaps so that we can hopefully prevent empty seats from happening. The media fades after a story, but those children and those family members continue having to live their lives without that loved one. And I appreciate the work we do in this report as a way to try and honor the lives of those victims. And I really encourage all the readers and listeners to take this report and honor those victims who've lost their lives and work with us to implement recommendations.
Ms. Tabb, is that where the best hope is, the sort of galvanizing effect of what's happened before?
I think so. And I think that's our goal with this report, is to say this is what's happening in our state. And we've had the opportunity to feature one person's story, but this could be any story, anybody's story. And this is the story of a lot of children. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done there. And I think that's where a lot of the hope lies, too.
Taylor Tabb is the Fatality Review Project Coordinator for the Georgia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Jennifer Thomas is Executive Director of the State Commission on Family Violence. Thanks to both of you for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.